Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really fascinating intersection of finance and technology. We're looking at how operating real estate businesses, think maybe like a regional chain of express car washes, can raise capital,
right?
Specifically by tokenizing their equity and doing it under Regulation D, Rule 506C.
Exactly. And it's important, you know, we're not just talking about digitizing ownership of the, like, the physical land and buildings.
Right. Not just the property itself.
No. The focus here is converting equity in the actual company that runs those car washes into digital tokens.
Okay, so investors get a piece of the whole operation.
That's the idea. They can potentially benefit from the overall success of the business, not just, you know, the property value going up.
Okay, let's unpack that core idea a bit more. Tokenization. What exactly is it?
Well, in essence, you're taking the rights to an asset, in this case, ownership in our car wash company, and representing those rights as digital tokens on a blockchain.
So like turning shares in a private business, which are normally hard to sell.
Yeah.
Exactly, traditionally illiquid.
Into smaller digital units.
Yeah, digital units that are secured by blockchain technology and potentially easier to transfer. Plus, you can automate certain things using smart contracts.
Smart contracts, right. We hear a lot about those. What's the big appeal there?
Well, what's particularly compelling here is the potential to unlock liquidity.
Okay.
In assets that have historically been, you know, difficult to trade quickly. By creating these digital ownership units, you can kind of envision a future where buying and selling fractions of these businesses becomes much more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, smart contracts open up possibilities for automating things, maybe profit distributions, compliance checks, that sort of thing.
Right. Okay, so for our car wash business to offer these tokenized shares in the U.S., they need to avoid the whole massive IPO process, right?
Generally, yes. They'll likely rely on an exemption provided by the SEC.
And that's where Regulation D comes in. Today, we're focusing on Rule 506C. What's special about 506C? The big thing, really, is that it permits general solicitation and advertising.
Which is different from other ways of raising private capital.
That, yeah, it's a significant departure.
Yeah.
Rule 506C allows issuers to openly talk about their offering. They could use their website, social media, you know, public channels.
To reach lots of potential investors.
Potentially, yes. A vast pool of accredited investors. That's the key difference from, say, Rule 506B, which strictly prohibits that kind of public advertising.
Ah, okay. But there's always a catch, isn't there? What's the trade-off with 506C?
The crucial condition is that all sales, every single one, must be exclusively to accredited investors.
Accredited investors. We should define that.
We will. But it's not just that they are accredited. The issuer can't just, you know, assume they are or take their word for it.
Mm-hmm.
No, they have to take what the SEC calls reasonable steps to actively verify that accredited status.
Okay, so that sounds like a pretty big hurdle, potentially.
It raises a core strategic question for any business thinking about this.
Yeah.
How do you balance that amazing opportunity of reaching more people through advertising?
Right.
With the strict requirement of only selling to verified accredited folks,
yeah,
and managing that whole verification process.
So let's get into those specifics. Let's really dive into Rule 506C.
Okay.
What are the real advantages and what are the limitations or maybe potential hurdles for a business like our car wash chain using this rule?
Okay, well, on the benefit side, the first big one is the unlimited capital raise.
Unlimited.
Yeah, unlike some other exemptions, there's no regulatory cap on the total amount of money a company can raise through a 506C offering.
Wow. So for a growing business, like our car wash example, wanting to expand.
It's huge. That lack of a funding ceiling means they can potentially go for aggressive expansion without hitting some, you know, artificial regulatory limit.
That's a massive potential upside. And then there's that general solicitation piece we mentioned, the ability to advertise publicly. How big a deal is that, really?
It could be absolutely transformative. I mean, traditionally, private fundraising often relied heavily on the issuer's personal network, right? Or very quiet, targeted outreach.
Right, who you know.
Exactly. Rule 506C opens the door to a much, much broader audience of potential investors, especially those who are active online, maybe following new investment trends.
So it helps companies without those established networks.
It can, yeah. For a newer issuer, or maybe a platform that facilitates these kinds of offerings, it's a really powerful tool to connect with accredited investors they might never have reached otherwise. It could potentially speed up their fundraising quite a bit.
Okay, it sounds like it could really level the playing field in some ways. Let's talk about the limitations. That accredited investors only rule, that seems like a pretty big constraint. Who actually qualifies?
Yeah, it is a major constraint. The SEC has pretty specific definitions. Generally, you're looking at individuals who meet high income thresholds.
Right.
Earning over $200,000 a year or $300,000 jointly with a spouse for the last 2 years and expecting the same this year, or having a net worth over $1 million, and that's excluding the value of their primary home.
Okay.
There are also categories for certain types of sophisticated entities and individuals holding specific professional licenses, like Series 7, 65, or 82.
So it's a relatively small percentage of the population.
A very small percentage. Some estimates say it excludes maybe 95% of the general public. So yeah, you could shout about your offering from the rooftops, metaphorically speaking.
Right.
But only that specific group, that wealthier demographic, can actually buy in.
Okay. So wide net for marketing, narrow pool for actual investment, and then there's this verification burden you mentioned earlier. That sounds like it could add real friction.
It's a key difference from Rule 506B. Under 506B, an issuer just needs a reasonable belief their investors are accredited. Often, they just rely on the investor checking a box, self-certifying.
But not with 506C.
No. 506C sets a much higher bar.
Yeah.
The issuer must take those reasonable steps to verify the status of every single buyer.
Yeah.
Just getting a signature on a form saying I'm accredited is not enough.
So you need proof, like documents.
Often, yeah. It requires a more thorough, documented verification process. We can get into the specifics of what that looks like.
Okay. And what about the tokens themselves? Are they freely tradable once someone buys them? You mentioned something about restrictions.
Right. Tokens issued under 506C are considered restricted securities.
Meaning
investors can't just turn around and sell them immediately on a public exchange or market. There's usually a mandatory holding period before they could be resold freely.
How long?
Well, for companies that already file reports with the SEC, the holding period under Rule 144 is often 1 year. For non-reporting companies, which many of these tokenizing businesses might be, it could potentially be longer.
So that idea of tokenization leading to instant liquidity?
It's complicated.
Yeah.
It impacts that immediate liquidity potential. Investors need to understand they might be in it for the medium to long haul.
Okay. So, summing up this part, unlimited capital potential, ability to advertise broadly, those are big pluses.
Yeah,
but offset by the strict accredited only rule, the tough verification requirement, and the fact the tokens aren't immediately liquid.
You got it. Those are the key trade-offs any operating business needs to weigh very carefully. The power of general solicitation is undeniable, but it absolutely comes with these strings attached.
Right. So let's dig into that general solicitation aspect more. How can businesses really maximize that opportunity while staying compliant?
Well, the main opportunity, like we said, is just reaching way more potential accredited investors without needing that pre-existing Rolodex.
Especially helpful for newer businesses, maybe.
Absolutely. Or for online platforms trying to build a community around these types of investments.
Mm.
It can seriously speed things up just by getting the word out to more eligible people.
Makes total sense in the digital age. But what are the compliance traps they need to avoid?
Okay, number one, and this is critical.
Yeah.
No matter how wide you cast your marketing net, every single person who actually buys the tokenized equity must be verified as accredited. The public advertising doesn't change that fundamental rule.
Got it. Verification is non-negotiable for actual purchasers.
Non-negotiable. Second, everything you say publicly, websites, social media, ads, whatever, is subject to federal and state anti-fraud rules.
Meaning, be truthful, don't mislead.
Exactly. No hyping potential returns or glossing over the risks. Transparency and accuracy are absolutely key.
Okay. What else?
Another potential wrinkle is the global reach of the internet. You know, if a U.S. company is advertising under 506C, people in other countries might see it.
International implications.
Right. That could create conflicts with securities laws in those other countries. It might mess up exemptions they might otherwise rely on, like reverse solicitation, where a foreign investor finds you without you soliciting them.
So you need to be careful about attracting non-U.S. investors if you're advertising broadly.
You do. You really need to think about the scope of your solicitation if you plan to include non-U.S. investors. It adds another layer of complexity.
It sounds like a real balancing act.
It is. And finally, think about the practical side. If your advertising actually works well.
Good problem to have.
Maybe. But you need the infrastructure to handle it. You need a robust system to deal with potentially lots of inquiries and, crucially, to efficiently verify the accredited status of everyone interested.
Right. You don't want a bottleneck where your compliance can't keep up with your marketing.
Exactly. That leads to frustrated investors and potential compliance failures if you rush the verification. Marketing and compliance have to be totally in sync for a 506C token offering.
Okay, let's zoom in on that verification step then. It sounds absolutely critical. You said reasonable steps. What does that actually mean day to day? And I think you mentioned some recent SEC guidance.
Yeah, the reasonable steps standard is objective. It depends on the specific facts, who the purchaser is, the nature of the offering. The SEC looks at things like, is it an individual or an entity? How are they claiming to be accredited? What do you, the issuer, already know about them? What are the offering terms? The key takeaway is that just accepting a checkbox self-certification is not enough under 506C.
Okay, so what methods are generally accepted as meeting this standard?
Well, the SEC provides a non-exclusive list. Methods include things like reviewing the investor's financial documents.
Like tax returns, bank statements.
Exactly. Tax returns for income verification or bank statements, brokerage statements, maybe even a credit report for net worth verification.
That sounds potentially invasive for the investor.
It can be, yeah. Another method is getting written confirmation from a third party, like a registered broker-dealer, an SEC-registered investment advisor, a licensed attorney, or a CPA. They'd need to confirm the investor's accredited status within the last 3 months.
Okay, relying on a professional.
Right. And there's a provision if you've already verified someone is accredited. You can generally rely on their written representation that they still qualify for up to 5 years, as long as you don't have any reason to believe otherwise.
Those traditional methods do sound like they could be a bit cumbersome, maybe slow things down.
They definitely can be time-consuming. And yeah, some investors might find it intrusive. That's partly why 506C wasn't always the most popular choice historically.
But you mentioned recent guidance from March 2025.
Yes, exactly. The SEC staff put out some significant interpretive guidance, and a no-action letter and some CNDIs that aims to ease this burden, but only in specific situations.
Okay, tell me more. What situations?
It focuses on offerings where investors are putting in a substantial amount of money. Specifically, if a natural person invests $200,000 or more,
okay,
or if certain types of legal entities invest $1 million or more,
right,
then the issuer can use a more streamlined verification method if certain conditions are met.
Interesting. What are the conditions?
The issuer needs to get the written representation from the investor. It has to confirm two things. One, that they are accredited, and two, importantly, that their investment is not being financed by a third party specifically to the purpose of this particular investment.
Okay. No special loans, just to meet the threshold.
Basically, yes. And the second condition is that the issuer can't have any knowledge that contradicts the investor's claims, either about their accredited status or about this third party financing aspect.
So if someone invests 200 cows or more, and signs a form saying they're accredited and didn't get a specific loan for this deal, and the issuer has no reason to doubt them.
Then, under this guidance, the issuer might be able to rely on that written representation without needing to dig into tax returns or bank statements for that specific investor.
That sounds like a pretty significant simplification, at least for those larger investors.
It is. It could really help streamline onboarding, especially for tokenization platforms dealing with high net worth individuals or institutions making big commitments.
But there's always, but this only applies to those high minimum investments.
Crucially, yes. This streamlined approach only works if those 200 kilo $1 birth thresholds are met. If an investor is putting in less, or if they qualify based on, say, holding a professional license,
then you still need the traditional methods.
You do. So platforms and issuers will likely need a tiered approach using this streamlined method where possible, but still having robust procedures for the traditional verification methods for everyone else.
Right. So it helps, but doesn't eliminate the verification challenge entirely. Still sounds like a positive step for making 506C more practical, especially for larger tokenization deals.
I think that's fair to say yes. Now, navigating the SEC rules is obviously key, but that's just the federal level. We also need to think about the states.
Yes. The state regulations, often called blue sky laws, right? How do they fit into a 506C offering?
Okay, so first, back at the federal level, remember you have to file that Form D with the SEC. That needs to happen no later than 15 calendar days after the first sale of securities in the offering.
Form D. Got it. Basic info about the issuer and the offering.
Right. And missing that deadline doesn't automatically kill your federal exemption, but the SEC won't be happy and could take action.
Okay, file Form D on time. Now, what about the states?
This is where it gets interesting. Because Rule 506 offerings are considered covered securities under a federal law called NSMIA, National Securities Markets Improvement Act. Because they're covered, states are preempted. They are prevented from requiring you to register the offering at the state level.
So you don't have to go through 50 different state registration processes.
Exactly. That's a huge burden lifted. Imagine the cost and complexity otherwise.
Definitely. So states are mostly out of the picture then.
Not completely. While they can't demand registration, states can still require certain things.
Like what?
Most states require what's called a notice filing. This usually means sending them a copy of the Form D you filed with the SEC. They also typically charge a filing fee.
Okay, notice filing and a fee.
And they usually require you to consent to service of process, basically, appointing an agent in the state who can receive legal papers on your behalf.
And these requirements are the same everywhere.
Unfortunately, no. The specific forms, the fees, the deadlines, they can vary quite a bit from state to state. So you need to track this carefully. Failure to comply can lead to state penalties.
So even with federal preemption saving you from state registration, there's still this layer of state-level paperwork and fees to manage.
Absolutely. And critically, states keep their full power to investigate and prosecute fraud related to any securities offering, including a 506 offering. Preemption doesn't stop anti-fraud enforcement.
Right. Makes sense. Now, does using 506C with its general solicitation change the state level picture compared to a quieter 506B offering?
It can, significantly,
Yeah.
because when you advertise publicly online, your offer is potentially seen by investors in every state.
Ah, so you might be deemed to be offering securities in many more states.
Precisely, compared to a targeted 506B offering where you might only deal with investors in a few states you already know. This broader reach under 506C could mean you have to make those notice filings and pay those fees in a lot more states.
Which means more administrative work and more cost.
Definitely. So managing state blue sky compliance becomes potentially much more complex and expensive when you use general solicitation. You really need a system to track where offers are going and where your actual buyers are located.
It really highlights the need for careful planning and good record keeping, especially if you're using 506C for a token offering.
Couldn't agree more. Now, maybe we should shift gears a bit and compare this whole tokenization approach under 506C to how things have traditionally been done in real estate, specifically syndication.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. Let's put them side by side. What are we talking about with traditional syndication, and how does tokenization stack up against it?
Okay, so traditional real estate syndication usually involves a sponsor, a manager, or developer who finds a deal and then pools money from passive investors to buy or develop that property.
So investors are like limited partners?
Often, yeah. The structure is typically an LLC or a limited partnership. The big advantages for investors are getting access to deals they couldn't do on their own, benefiting from professional management, potentially getting some nice tax advantages, and diversifying within real estate.
Sounds pretty good. What are the downsides of that traditional model?
The biggest one is usually illiquidity. Your money is typically locked up for a long time, often years, until the property is sold or refinanced.
Right. Hard to get your money out early if you need it.
Very hard. Plus, investors usually have very little control over decisions. You're really relying on the sponsor's expertise and hoping they do a good job. There can also be potential conflicts of interest around fees and compensation for the sponsor. And the minimum investment can still be pretty high, maybe $50K, $100 or more.
Okay, so illiquidity, lack of control, sponsor dependence, and high minimums are the main drawbacks. Now, how does equity tokenization, especially using 506C, compare? What are the potential upsides it brings?
Well, the big promise is potential for enhanced liquidity.
Potential again, keyword.
Absolutely key. Through the development of secondary trading platforms, alternative trading systems or ATSs, there's the idea that these tokens could be traded more easily than traditional LP interests. But these markets are still very new.
Okay, potential liquidity. What else?
Lower investment minimums. Because
Yeah.
you can divide ownership into tiny fractions with tokens, you could theoretically allow people to invest much smaller amounts, maybe hundreds or thousands of dollars instead of tens of thousands.
That could open it up to more people.
Potentially, yes. It could increase accessibility, especially to that global pool of accredited investors we talked about. Blockchain also offers greater transparency. You can see the record of ownership, And smart contracts, as we mentioned, could automate things like distributions, potentially making it more efficient.
Okay, those sound like strong potential advantages. Liquidity, accessibility, transparency, efficiency. But what about the downsides of tokenization versus traditional syndication?
There are definitely challenges. The regulatory landscape is still evolving and complex. You've got securities law, KYC AML, blue sky, maybe international rules. It's a lot to
That's
navigate.
complexity we've been discussing.
Then there are technology risks. Is the blockchain secure? Are the smart contracts bug-free? What if the platform goes down? And as we keep saying, those secondary markets are immature. Liquidity is not guaranteed, volumes can be low, and those holding periods still apply.
So the liquidity promise isn't always reality yet.
Not yet, not consistently. Plus, you need investor education. Not everyone understands tokens or digital wallets. And the upfront costs, legal, tech setup can actually be higher for tokenization than for a traditional syndication right now. Valuation can also be tricky for these new types of assets.
Okay, so it's a real mix. Potential for big improvements in liquidity and access, but countered by regulatory hurdles, tech risks, market immaturity, and potentially higher upfront costs. We actually have a chart summarizing these pros and cons, which is helpful.
Yeah, it lays it out clearly.
Now, how does this comparison change when we think specifically about operating businesses, like our car wash chain, not just a passive piece of real estate?
Ah, that adds another layer of complexity for sure. Valuing the equity becomes much harder. You're not just valuing the land and buildings, you have to value the ongoing business, its cash flows, its brand, management, market position.
Much more complex than just appraising a building.
Definitely. And defining investor rights gets trickier. What exactly does the token represent? Is it just a share of the property value appreciation, or does it include a slice of the actual car wash profits?
That needs to be crystal clear.
Crystal clear in the legal documents. Smart contracts can help automate distributing those operational profits if they're included, but the definition has to be legally sound. Disclosure also needs to be broader in the PPM, covering risks of both the real estate and the operating business.
It sounds like the legal agreements become even more critical for an operating business tokenization.
Absolutely. In traditional syndication, the GPLP roles are pretty well understood. With tokenization, you might have many more investors, maybe globally, holding small pieces. You need incredibly clear governance rules baked into the legal agreements, possibly reinforced by smart contracts, to avoid disputes down the road about how the business is run or how profits are shared. Clarity is just paramount when people are buying into an active operating company.
Okay, that paints a clear picture of the comparison and the extra considerations for operating businesses. So let's walk through the actual process. If our car wash owner decides, yes, I want to tokenize my equity under 506C, what are the steps?
It's a multi-stage process, definitely. Step one is really about deal structuring and asset evaluation. As we just discussed, for an operating business, this means deep due diligence, legal, financial, operational on the business itself, plus valuing the real estate. Then you define the token economics. How many tokens, what price, what percentage of the company equity do they represent?
Step one, know exactly what you're tokenizing and the basic terms. What's next?
Step two is the legal structuring. This often means setting up a new legal entity, an SPV special purpose vehicle, usually an LLC to hold the operating company equity or maybe the real estate assets. You pick a jurisdiction and you draft all the crucial legal documents.
The PPM subscription agreement?
Exactly. The private placement memorandum outlining risks, management, etc. The subscription agreement the investor signs. And a detailed operating agreement defining token holder rights, governance, distributions, how token transfers work on the blockchain, how smart contracts interact with it all. A lot of legal heavy lifting up front.
Definitely sounds like it. Okay, legal structure is set, then comes the tech.
Yep. Step three is technology selection. Choosing the right blockchain, maybe a public one like Ethereum or Polygon, or a purpose-built one like Polymesh designed for securities. Choosing the right token standard like ERC-20, or maybe a security-specific standard like ERC-1404 or Polymesh's ST-20, and crucially, selecting a tokenization platform or provider.
The platform that will actually help issue the tokens.
Right. They might handle issuance, maybe secondary trading eventually, or offer a full end-to-end service. There are different models.
Okay, legal and tech foundations laid. Step four.
Step four is actually creating the tokens and implementing the smart contracts. This involves minting the tokens on the chosen blockchain and developing and deploying the smart contracts that automate things.
Like transfer rules,
Yeah,
profit distribution.
exactly. transfer restrictions like whitelisting verified investors, enforcing lockup periods, automating distributions, maybe handling voting if tokens have voting rights, compliance checks, even managing the cap table digitally.
And security is key here, right?
Absolutely critical. You need rigorous third-party security audits of those smart contracts before they go live. Any bug could be disastrous.
Right.
Many platforms offer pre-built audited templates, which can help, but customization might be limited.
Makes sense. Audit. Okay. Tokens are minted, smart contracts are deployed, now we sell them.
Exactly. Step 5 is the primary offering. The STO, security token offering, and distributing the tokens. This means defining your marketing strategy, remembering general solicitation is allowed under 506C, but only to accredited investors, using your chosen platform for investor onboarding.
Which includes the KYC mail checks and that all-important accredited investor verification?
Precisely. Collecting the investment funds could be fiat, could be crypto,
right,
and then actually distributing the tokens to the investors' digital wallets.
Okay, the initial sale is done, but compliance doesn't stop there.
Not by a long shot.
Yeah.
Step 6 is ongoing compliance, continuous KYC mail monitoring. Diligently applying those reasonable steps for verification, maybe using the new SEC guidance for the big investors, maintaining whitelists, often enforced by the smart contracts, filing Form D on time, and handling all the State Blue Sky notice filings as needed. It's continuous.
Right. And then step 7 is about what happens after the initial issuance, getting them potentially tradable.
Yes. Step 7 is getting the tokens onto a platform for management and potential secondary trading. Initially, they'll likely live on the issuance platform. But for trading, you need to list them on a compatible, regulated, alternative trading system, an ATS.
And that's a separate, complex step.
It is. It involves meeting the ATS's listing rules, getting legal opinions, technical integration, often requires involving a registered transfer agent, too. Ideally, you start talking to ATSs before you even issue the tokens.
Good planning is key.
Absolutely. And beyond listing, there's ongoing investor relations, managing distributions, facilitating voting, staying compliant, and of course, running the actual underlying operating business. Liquidity on an ATS isn't automatic. You have to actively engage with that ecosystem.
Wow. That's a really comprehensive overview. It's clearly a sophisticated process with lots of moving parts, legal, tech, compliance, ongoing management.
It really is. And a huge piece of making it work is choosing the right tokenization platform.
Right. Let's talk about that. There seem to be quite a few platforms popping up. If you're a car wash owner, what should you look for when picking one for a 506C equity tokenization?
Several things are crucial. First off, their regulatory compliance framework. Do they really understand Reg D 506C? Do they have solid documented processes for accredited investor verification? For KYCML, can they help with blue sky filings? That's table stakes.
You need a platform that lives and breathes this specific regulation. Makes sense. What else?
You need to check their suitability for your specific asset type equity in an operating business. Do they have experience with that? Or just with simple passive real estate? Can their tech handle the complexities, like distributing operational profits or specific governance features?
Right. Not all real estate tokenization is the same. Operating businesses are different.
Exactly. Then look at their technology stack. What blockchains do they support? What token standards? Are those standards compatible with the ATSs you might want to list on later? How flexible and secure are their smart contracts? Do they offer APIs if you need to integrate with other systems?
So the tech needs to fit the specific needs and future plans. What about managing the investors after the sale?
Investor management features are vital. How do they handle communication, distributions, fiat, or crypto? Voting systems, if needed. Reporting, especially for tax purposes. And critically, what's their story on secondary market support?
The liquidity question again.
Always. Do they have their own regulated ATS? Or do they have strong partnerships and proven integrations with other ATSs? How easy or hard do they make it to actually get your token listed for trading? That pathway to potential liquidity is huge.
Absolutely critical if liquidity is a major goal. Any other factors?
Yeah, consider their investor network. Do they help connect you with relevant accredited investors? What's their fee structure like? And definitely check their track record and reputation. Ask for case studies. Talk to other issuers who've used them.
And verify their credentials.
Yes. Crucially, check their actual regulatory registrations. Are they, or their partners, properly registered as a broker-dealer, ATS, transfer agent where needed? Don't just take their word for it, and confirm they have demonstrable experience with 506C and with operating business equity.
So deep due diligence is required. It's about regulatory soundness, relevant experience, and that pathway to secondary markets.
You nailed it. And based on what's out there now, a few names often come up in these discussions.
Oh, yeah. Which ones are generally seen as key players in this specific space operating real estate equity under 506C?
Well, you often hear about Securitize. They emphasize compliance, have an integrated ATS, and experience across different asset types. Vortello is another one, focusing on asset lifecycle management, transfer agent tech, multi-chain support, and they have experience with RegD and ATS integrations.
Okay. Any others?
Then you have players like INX and T0. They both operate regulated ATSs and have experience trading security tokens. INX even did its own registered offering. T0 has specific real estate token experience. For them, you'd want to clarify the depth of their primary issuance services for this kind of deal, as their main focus might be the secondary trading side. We actually have a summary table comparing these as well.
Super helpful context on the platform landscape. Okay, pulling back to the big picture again. What are the absolute top-level legal and regulatory things someone doing this needs to constantly keep in mind?
Number one is just strict securities law compliance everywhere that matters.
Yeah.
Federally, in the U.S., these tokens are securities. You need that registration or a valid exemption like 506C, and you have to follow all the rules of that exemption, accredited only, verification, anti-fraud, always applies.
Federal compliance is job one.
Then state blue sky laws. Remember, no state registration needed for 506, but you do have notice filings, fees, consent to service, and states keep their anti-fraud power. General solicitation likely means dealing with more states.
Right, the multi-state compliance burden.
And if you're thinking globally, you absolutely need to navigate the securities laws in every country you target. U.S. rules might conflict with foreign rules. It's a complex, multi-jurisdictional puzzle that really needs expert legal help.
Legal expertise is non-negotiable. What about the smart contracts themselves? Do they have their own legal baggage?
They do. While they offer great automation potential, their legal enforceability is still kind of an emerging area. Basic contract law principles apply, but translating legal nuance into code is hard, and fixing mistakes on an immutable blockchain is harder.
So code isn't automatically law.
But not necessarily. Things like the eSIGN Act help with electronic contracts, but standards for smart contracts are still developing. It's usually best practice to have the smart contract execute what's clearly defined in your traditional legal documents, the PPM, the operating agreement. Those remain the primary source of truth, especially for complex governance in an operating business. And again, security audits are non-negotiable for those contracts.
Got it. Legal docs rule, smart contracts execute. What about managing the investors once they hold the tokens? Key protocols there.
Clear definition of rights in the offering documents is paramount economic rights, governance rights. Clear mechanism for distributions automated via smart contract is common. If there's voting, you need a reliable system, on-chain or off. Regular, transparent communication and reporting are essential. Updates, financials, tax info. Platforms often help with this.
And record keeping. Isn't the blockchain the record?
The blockchain is a record, a very transparent one, but the issuer, likely with a registered transfer agent, is still legally responsible for maintaining the official book entry records of who owns the securities.
Okay, that's an important distinction. And finally, taxes. Always taxes.
Always. The tax treatment depends on what the token represents, equity-like, debt-like. Investors generally owe tax on distributions and on capital gains when they sell. There might be withholding for foreign investors. The issuer SPV pays his own taxes too.
So specialized tax advice is also a must.
Absolutely essential for both the issuer and the investors. You need tax pros who understand digital assets and securities law. It's a specialized area.
It really sounds like this whole endeavor, tokenizing operating real estate equity under 506C, requires a deep understanding of tech, finance, and a whole lot of complex, evolving law and regulation.
That sums it up perfectly. It offers exciting potential, accessing capital differently, fractional ownership, maybe better liquidity down the road. But the regulatory maze, the verification burden, the immature secondary markets, the tech risks, the complexities of operating businesses, it's significant.
So for any business owner listening, maybe running that car wash chain and thinking, maybe this is for me, what are your final key strategic recommendations?
Okay, my must-dos would be, one, get specialized legal counsel involved from day zero experts in securities and blockchain. Two, vet potential tokenization platforms incredibly thoroughly focused on their 506C and operating business equity experience and their ATS integration story. Three, make your legal agreements the bedrock crystal clear rights, governance defined there, not just in code. Four, build a robust tiered verification process. Use the SEC guidance for high minimums, but have solid procedures for everyone else. 5. Plan for liquidity. Proactively talk to ATSs early. And 6. Budget realistically. Expect significant upfront costs for legal, tech, and compliance.
Fantastic practical advice. That really brings together everything we've discussed. So to wrap up, let's leave our listeners with something to chew on.
Okay.
Given this rapidly changing legal scene and the constant innovation in blockchain, how might tokenization reshape things in the future? Not just real estate finance, but maybe the fundamental idea of what business ownership looks like and how investors participate.
That's a big question. Definitely something to think about.
It certainly is. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive today.